Sorry, we're going to start late here again. I'm trying to devise a better system to get all this stuff in order and set up and so forth. You should have in front of you a set of notes for lesson 108. William the Translator, and we're going to be talking today about his work. Is there any extra ones? We're going to be looking at his work today on the Old Testament, okay? So that's what we're going to be primarily focused on here this morning. So I want to get right into it here with the introduction. Lessons 106 and 107 were focused on a consideration of Dr. David Norton's thesis that Tyndale's New Testament served as the rough draft for the King James New Testament some 80 years later. Little was said in these lessons regarding Tyndale's work on the Old Testament. So the last two studies where we were looking at some things related to the relationship between William Tyndale's translation and ultimately the King James Bible, we were primarily focused on the New Testament when we were doing that. This morning what I want to do is look at some stuff about the Old Testament and Tyndale's translational work on the Old Testament. I'm spending a lot of time on Tyndale. I know that. I'm doing it for a reason, because he is absolutely foundational and pivotal for the Bible in English, especially for the King James Bible, and not only the Bible in English, but for the form of English that became adopted and spoken by people in England at the time. Therefore, the focus of this lesson will be upon Tyndale's translation work on the Old Testament. Now, I have given, there is a link here, so when these notes go live on the internet, you will be able to click there and view a website that has a link to Tyndale's 1530 Pentateuch, or the first five books of the Old Testament, where you can actually look at them, all right? I was thinking about trying to show them, and if we have time at the end, I'll show you them, but I also have some photos here that we'll be looking at here after a while, okay? At the outset, please recall the following points taken from Lesson 105 on the life and times of William Tyndale regarding his work on the Old Testament. So, we saw in Lesson 105 the following points regarding the Old Testament. Amidst the chaos at home in England in 1530, also saw Tyndale translate and publish the Pentateuch in English. So when we talk about the Pentateuch, we're obviously talking about the first five books of the Old Testament, right? Genesis through Deuteronomy. We saw, quote, "the hierarchy is still on high alert for the apprehension of William Tyndale. Vaugh, the English envoy and successor to Hatchett," so that's some political stuff that we talked about in a previous lesson, "has a special commission to watch Tyndale's movements. In the meantime, Tyndale has been engaged in translating the Pentateuch aided, doubtless, by his friend Firth, who at the persecution at Oxford fled across the sea. These five books were printed separately. David Daniel adds they could also have been be bought together, with titles and prologues to each, but without dates, excepting that of Genesis. These books are quite rare, since there is but one complete set known to have been preserved in the Grenville Library, British Museum." Another quote regarding that was, "the original Hebrew text of the Pentateuch, or of anything, was in English for the first time." So we've talked about this. Before Tyndale, that no one had ever taken any Hebrew and translated it into English. He is the first one to take the Hebrew text and render it in English in any form at all. So he is a trendsetter there. And then you have the statement there in Latin, which I'm not even going to try to say. So the reason we have the statement, "let there be light and there was light," is because of the translational work of William Tyndale. Obviously a very famous statement from Genesis chapter 1, right? And Tyndale is also the one that gives us the name of God as Jehovah. So those are some review points of what we saw there in Lesson 105. Also we saw, as noted earlier in 1530, Tyndale translated and released the five books of Moses separately, each with its own title page. In 1534, they were all bound together and reissued in a standalone volume. As for the rest of the Old Testament is concerned, Condit reports, "the book of Jonah was translated by Tyndale in 1531, but was not reprinted. There has been some doubt as to how much of the Old Testament Tyndale translated. Hall, the chronicler, claims that beside the New Testament and the Pentateuch, he completed the books of Joshua, Judges, Ruth, the four books of Kings. So don't get confused, right? We talked about that before. In the Hebrew Bible, there are four books of Kings. In your Bible, there are two, same material, just set out or laid out differently. The two books of Chronicles, Nehemiah, and the first book of Esdras and the prophet Jonah. But whether Tyndale may have left behind, but whatever Tyndale may have left behind in manuscript, he only published, besides the New Testament, the Pentateuch, and the book of Jonah. That Tyndale translated directly from the Hebrew, and that he was a master of that language, there is no longer any question. So, there's some doubt a little bit if he ever bound all five of those books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, if he ever bound them all together in one volume in 1530. But for sure, by 1534, he put all five together and they were all published together in a volume. Okay, so I have here a couple things. First, this is Tyndale's Old Testament. This was edited, I'm going to talk about this here in a second. This is edited and put out in 1992 by Dr. David Daniel of Yale University. This was for Yale University Press, in which he takes all of Tyndale's translational work on the Old Testament and put it together in one volume with modern English spellings. So you can actually read that. You can read the old stuff, but it's a lot more difficult. You really have to focus your attention, as I'll show you here in a moment, on some of these photos that I have. Okay, so I want to talk primarily then about Tyndale's Old Testament. Everything we just went through is review. I covered that stuff in lessons 104 and 105 when we looked at the life and times of William Tyndale. Today I want to focus specifically on his work on the Old Testament. Okay. So, in 1992, Dr. David Daniel edited a modern spelling edition of Tyndale's Old Testament for Yale University Press. Again, that's this book right here. You can buy this online. I'm not sure how much it is. I don't think it's terribly cheap.
$100 or more or less.
Okay, around $100 you can pick one up if you're interested. Wanda actually gave me that for free some years ago. So, if Wanda, you're listening to this, I appreciate you doing that. This volume included Tyndale's Pentateuch, so that's what's in this volume right here. It's got Genesis through Deuteronomy from 1530, and then it also has Joshua to 2 Chronicles from 1537. We'll talk about what that means here in a minute, okay? It also has the book of Jonah, as well as an explanatory introduction of its contents and layout. Dr. Daniel's introduction to Tyndale's Old Testament opens with the following sentiments. He says, quote, William Tyndale's Old Testament translations laid the foundation of our English Bible. They have been even more hidden from general view than his work on the New Testament. Half of what appears in this volume has not been generally accessible since 1551. It's one reason why this book is a little bit pricey. A lot of the stuff that's in this book, you literally can't probably find it in a format that you can really access as a modern reader unless you have this particular edition. So there's definitely some value in that. Tyndale published his first translations from Hebrew into English, the earliest ever from that language into this, in 1530 when he printed his Pentateuch. So again, Tyndale is the first guy to take Hebrew and translate it into English. No one had ever done this before Tyndale. He gave us Bible language, the words and rhythms, for example, of the story of the creation and the fall. Let there be light, and there was light. Male and female created he them. Who told thee thou wast naked, and much else. Two generations later, in 1611, the scholars and divines who made the authorized version under King James were happy to use what Tyndale had given them, though without acknowledgement. Many great passages from the Pentateuch come to us from Tyndale, like the blessing from Numbers 6. The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face to shine upon thee and be merciful unto thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. ringing phrases such as "From the Lord, for the Lord thy God is a consuming fire," or "a mighty hand and a stretched out arm," from Deuteronomy 4 and from Deuteronomy 6. "For the Lord thy God is a jealous God," as well as "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might." These and many, many more come to us from his Pentateuch. So when you're reading what Tyndale says in this Pentateuch, you're basically reading what is adopted in large measure later on, as we've already seen, by the King James translators, right? So those very famous phrases from the Old Testament are first set into English by Tyndale in 1530. Yet that volume was less than half his Old Testament work. 2 years after his execution in 1535, this is actually a mistake, he was executed in 1536, not 1535, there appeared a thick folio Bible, also printed abroad, which announced itself as "set forth with the King's most gracious license," making a change to Henry VIII's policy, and truly and purely translated into English by Thomas Matthew. Matthew is a cover name. So I also have here a 1537 facsimile reprint of a Matthew's Bible. Okay, I picked this up at Baker Bookhouse some years ago, and it has in it, if you get past all the introduction information, this is the front page, where it talks about the Bible being printed for the king and so on and so forth, right? Or as a representation of the king's authority. So why is this important to Tyndale? Okay. This volume was in fact assembled by Tyndale's close friend John Rogers, who later became the first Protestant martyr in England under the Catholic Queen Mary. In his Matthew's Bible, Rogers reprinted the Pentateuch and all of the New Testament directly from Tyndale. So if you look at this Matthew's Bible and you compare the New Testament with Tyndale's Bibles from 1534 and 1535, the Matthew's New Testament is basically identical to what Tyndale put out some 2-3 years before. Okay? But what Matthew also included is all the available work of Tyndale on the Old Testament. So he includes Tyndale's Pentateuch, Genesis through Deuteronomy, and more besides in the 1537 Matthew's Bible. Okay, the section after the Pentateuch, from Joshua to 2 Chronicles, was also Tyndale's work. For this section, there is, it has been said, no direct evidence. Yet the strong likelihood, together with an overwhelming accumulation of internal effects, convinces the general reader and the scholar that this is Tyndale, probably from his manuscripts entrusted to Rogers at his death. So we should probably pause there for a minute. Does everybody understand what I'm saying so far? We know Tyndale translates in 1530 the first five books of the Old Testament. In 1531, it is known that he translated also the book of Jonah. But he also translates, as it said there in the quote, he also is responsible for, let me make sure I get this right, Joshua to 2 Chronicles. That was never published by Tyndale while he was alive, but it is published by his friend Thomas Matthew in the 1537 Matthew's Bible. And again, I should say it, Thomas Matthew is a cover name for the guy's real name, which is John Rogers, okay? I would say to you that him even saying, even in 1537, saying that he is representing the King of England is a bold move on his part, because he had no crown authority to really do that in 1537, which is why he does this under an assumed name. Okay, so John Rogers is putting this out. He was a longtime friend of Tyndale in 1537 under an assumed name. It includes all the New Testament from Tyndale, the first five books of the Old Testament from Tyndale, Joshua to 2 Chronicles from Tyndale, as well as the book of Jonah. All right. So anybody have a question or a comment or need a clarification? Yeah.
When you said that they assumed under King James that all his works were pulled in, was that because of convenience? Or was that, in your research, is that because of he was trusted, and then they checked and balanced against that?
Okay, I'm confused a little bit by your question regarding King James.
I'm sorry, you mentioned that much of what was printed in the 1611.
Yes.
Was brought up, his works were brought in.
Yes.
Was that because they were trusted and it was just kind of a, well, this is going to make this much easier, or was it, we checked and balanced it and hey, this guy's got something going, we're going to trust this?
It's really, the way I see it is it works like this, okay? Tyndale's the first guy to set it out. He translates the text of Erasmus into English, and he does 1526. He revises it in 1534. He revises it again in 1535. Okay? Moving forward, Coverdale. In 1535, I don't know where the eraser went. Here it is. In 1535, Coverdale is going to put the first full Bible into English. He beats John Roger with the Matthew's Bible by 2 years, right? But what Coverdale advances is fundamentally the work of who? Tyndale, right? Well, then the next one is the Matthew Bible, which we just were talking about. That one's in 1537. Then the next one after that, I'm just going to abbreviate it, is the Great Bible. That one's in 1539. So Coverdale is responsible for this one and this one, which he fundamentally got the text for, at least in the New Testament, from who? From Tyndale, right? Well, then the next one is the Geneva. And that was, the New Testament was in 1557, the full Bible was in 1560, and then the next one was the bishops, which was 1568 for the first edition, right? And then if you follow this and come back over here, then you ultimately have in 1611 what? King James, right? Well, when these guys here are using King James, and we did have different stats on that, of 4/5 or 83% of the New Testament that's in the King James fundamentally being Tyndale, right? That's because, AJ, there's a Tyndalean line, if I could say it that way, going all the way through this and ending up here. Okay? So that's how good a job Tyndale did in putting it into English for the first time way back here. Okay? So when they're over here and they're translating, their base text is a bishop's Bible. The first rule given to the translators was that they should follow what Bible? The bishop's Bible, right? Well, the bishop's Bible is fundamentally answering to who? Tyndale with slight revision, right? So when these guys sit down over here between 1604 and 1611 to translate the King James Bible, and rule number one is to follow the bishop's Bible unless the truth of the original says otherwise, they're following a Bible that's in the stream in the line of Tyndale. So the reason this is 83% Tyndale is fundamentally because this is at least 83% what? Tyndale.
But they didn't go all the way back to Tyndale's works directly.
Not necessarily. Not in every case, no. But there's that line of Tyndale through all of that. Some of them even being almost direct reproductions of Tyndale in these early ones here. Okay?
But the King James translators were looking at the original Hebrew.
They were looking at everything. They were looking at all of these previous Bibles. It's a point of some inconvenience for some King James advocates, but they also looked at the Reims, the Catholic Reims New Testament from the 1580s. I can show you without a doubt that there are Reams readings in the King James Bible. There's words and phrases that are in the King James Bible that were put there because of the way they were stated in the Reams. Now that's a heresy, okay? I'll probably get 6 emails about that saying what a terrible person I am because I said it. But the textual evidence bears that out to be the case, right? So they're looking at Hebrew, they're looking at Greek, they're looking at all these previous Bibles that are in that lot, that are in that sort of, historical timeline that I just drew up there when they're making their decisions.
Even a broken clock is right twice a day, so that's
yeah. So we need to move on. Later in his introduction, Dr. Daniel presents his evidence for arguing that William Tyndale was the translator for the text of Joshua through 2 Chronicles as found in the Matthew's Bible of 1537. For the sake of time and space, I have limited my citations of Daniel's work on this point to what I believe are his most important points. Okay, he goes on in this, he goes on in the introduction for quite a long time on this, way more than I felt like I needed to quote for these notes to make the point. Okay, so he says, quote, in that introduction, Matthew's Bible reprints Tyndale in the Pentateuch and the New Testament. From the end of 2 Chronicles to the end of the Old Testament, it prints Coverdale. So, this Bible prints a combination of Coverdale's work from 1535 and Tyndale's work on both the Old and the New Testaments. Okay? Who is the translator, though, of Joshua to 2 Chronicles? The case for this being Tyndale rests upon 5 points. The first three carry such a weight as they make the ascription virtually certain. Number one, Tyndale's way with Hebrew can be very much his own, as we have noted above. When he strikes out independently of any immediate influences, so that would be Luther, the Septuagint, or the Vulgate, he leaves, as it were, a distinctive signature on his treatment of Hebrew words. The musical instrument in Hebrew is tof, I don't know how you say that, is consistently translated by Coverdale, I think that should say in the books from Ezra onwards, as tabret. In the Pentateuch, Tyndale makes it timbrel, as this is the word in Judges 11, 1 Samuel 10, 1 Samuel 18, 2 Samuel 6, and 1 Chronicles 13. Examples of such continuity of idiosyncrasy, as we might put it, can be found many times and accumulate to make a powerful case. So, in other words, when you read that section of the Matthew's Bible, is it consistently dealing with that word the same way Tyndale did in his Pentateuch? Which is decidedly different from the way Coverdale dealt with that word. Okay? So there's an idiosyncrasy in the way Tyndale translates that Hebrew word that's found in his, I'm going to write it down here, in his 1530 Pentateuch that shows up in those sections of the Matthew Bible. Okay? So in those sections that follow that idiosyncrasy, it seems logical to reason that in that case, who's providing the translation in the Matthew Bible? Tyndale. Is everybody following that? This is going to get a little, you got to put your thinking cap on, okay? So there's the issue of the Tyndalean way of dealing with certain words that show up, okay? Second, the translator of Joshua to 2 Chronicles shows exactly the same desire to make sense almost at all costs as Tyndale in the Pentateuch. It has been seen above that such nearly impenetrable Hebrew passages as the accounts of the furniture of the temple almost defeat him. The same can be said of his descriptions of the ritual garments in Leviticus and Numbers. So in other words, when you look at what's going on and you compare this section of the Matthew's Bible, and again, we're talking here, I'm going to write it up here, we're talking about Joshua through what? 2 Chronicles, right? So there's stuff in there that when you compare it, it matches exactly with the way it was described by Tyndale Ware. Now think about that. This is just a thing for you to consider. Has anybody before this point translated any of this Hebrew stuff into English? And so then you go into the text of the Hebrew text and you find this description of this furniture and this layout and this setup that no one's really ever what? Encountered before in Hebrew and had to try to say it in English. And so when you look at those similarities, they point in the direction of Tyndale being the translator of both. Okay? Skipping ahead. Four. There are the same particular formulations and English phrasing in both, such as men of activity, the literal, the fat of the land, observe dismal days, upon high mountains and on high hills and under every green tree and very many more, right? So when we look at Joshua to 2 Chronicles in the Matthew Bible, do we see the same phraseologies being used that Tyndale used in 1530 when he did the Pentateuch? Okay? So we've got the same idiosyncrasies, we've got the same structures of explaining the stuff, some of the difficult stuff in the temple and, or the tabernacle there and so forth, and also some of the exact same phraseologies. Number five. Finally, there is evidence of large ornamental initials in Matthew's. Those in the introductory matter, IR and HR, are taken to stand for John Rogers, and that would be the old way of a J, by the way. We say it looks like an I to us. I'll show you what I'm talking about if I can find it quick. It's in here. I'm not finding it quick enough, am I? Here's the HR initial. So that this is, there's an initial at the bottom of the section. And if you go to a, and there's the initial that's taken to be John Rogers. Okay, so this is a common thing that people would do at the time, right? So go back to point five there. Finally, there is evidence of large ornamental initials in Matthew. Those in the introductory matter, IR and HR, are taken to stand for John Rogers and
Henricus
Rex. Before the prophets, RG and EW, are taken to be Richard Grafton and Edward Whitechurch, the London printers who financed and distributed the volume, and WT at the end of the Old Testament before the Apocrypha. So I did mark that, I think. So if you look at this, here's the WT initial at the end of the Old Testament, and on the facing page is the beginning of the Apocryphal books. Okay? So this is the WT, this is the facing page with the Apocryphal books right there. That's a cover page for that. We'll talk about the Apocrypha in a future lesson, all right? So back to the notes. Edward Hall, in his Chronicle of 1548, adds the Old Testament historical books to a list of Tyndale's translations. Moreover, copies of Matthew's exist in which all the prologues and all the notes have been obliterated to escape the penalties that were threatened in 1543 when, as Bishop Westcott notes, Parliament postscribed all translations bearing the name Tyndale and required that the notes and all other copies should be removed or obliterated. So they don't like Tyndale. All right? So there's four or five different lines of reasoning to suggest that Tyndale also translates Joshua through 2 Chronicles, that his friend John Rogers uses his translations in the Matthew's Bible from 1537. And so then that would mean that the Matthew's Bible would be Tyndale. Let's just sort of drop this down. The Matthew's Bible then would be Tyndale in Genesis through Revelation. It would be Tyndale in Joshua. So Josh through 2 Chronicles. It would be Tyndale also in the book of what? Jonah. Okay? Any questions about that? Perfect. Therefore, I think it's safe to conclude that Tyndale's translation accomplishments with respect to the Old Testament include the following before his martyrdom in 1536. You would have then his 1530 Pentateuch, which includes in it William Tyndale to the reader. So I have a few pictures here. So this is the cover page. This is the link where you can go to actually get this. But this is the first book of Moses called Genesis. This is a picture exactly from the 1530 Pentateuch. And then here we have this page shows William Tyndale to the reader. And then this page shows his prologue showing the use of Scripture, where he deals with and explains how Scripture is supposed to be used. And again, I took these images straight out of a 1530 Pentateuch. So in that, you would have William Tyndale to the reader, you would have the prologue on the use of Scripture, Then you would have the first book of Moses called Genesis. So I'm reading from the list. After Genesis, he included a table expounding certain words, a prologue into the second book of Moses called Exodus. Then he has a table expounding certain words of the second book of Moses. Then he actually has the book of Exodus. Then he's got a prologue to Leviticus, the book of Leviticus, a prologue to Moses, or a prologue to Numbers, and then Numbers, and then a prologue to Deuteronomy, and then the book of Deuteronomy. So that's the contents of what's in the 1530 Pentateuch if you actually go and look at it. And I do encourage you later on to go check it out. You can look at it. It's very interesting to do that and see what it looked like, how it was set up, how it was laid out. Now, you can read this stuff. You just have to sort of have a trained eye to be able to do it. This is English. This is not Greek, Hebrew, or Latin. This is English here. It's just the typesetting and the font is obviously difficult, as well as some of the spelling is not what you're used to. Okay. Then if you go to the next point, in addition to all that from the first five books, then you would add to his work from the 1537 Matthew's Bible. He did Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, and then he also does both books of the Chronicles, and then he also did Jonah. Okay, so that's the extent of his Old Testament translational work as far as what we have in the different witnesses, I guess would be the word for it. Okay, excuse me. So all told, then, Tyndale is responsible for penning the rough draft for 15 of the 39 books, or 38% of the Old Testament found in the King James Bible. Okay? In addition to producing full English renderings for the 15 books listed above, it is important to note that Tyndale's 1534 and 1535 New Testament revisions also included English translations for a select number of Old Testament passages not included in the preceding list. Okay? So this gets interesting. If you look at the last point on page 4, these additional Old Testament translations can be found in the back of his New Testament revisions from 1534 and 1535 after the book of Revelation in a section titled, these are the epistles taken out of the Old Testament which are read in the church after the use of Salisbury upon certain days of the year. Now we got to talk about this for a minute. So I want to show you this. If I can get this to work, we'll go to the next one. Okay. So this is the page I'm talking about. So this is from the Old Testament Salisbury Epistles from 1534 New Testament Revision. All right. So I have the English version of this so I can read all this language to you here. But it says here, these are the epistles taken out of the Old Testament which are to be read in the church after the order of Salisbury upon certain days of the year. The first Friday in Advent, the epistle, and then this is going to be from Isaiah 51. So there's a liturgical calendar that the church is following, okay? And in the back of his 1534 New Testament, he includes extra translations of the portions of the liturgical Psalter that was being used into English so that the people who were following that system could actually know and read and understand what was going on as they followed that system. Okay? So, a lot of people might get mad at Tyndale for this, right? Because this is kind of a Catholic thing a little bit to having this liturgy there, right? But remember that I don't want to be too hard on Tyndale given the day and the time in which he lived here, right? His mind is simply to give people access to the scripture in their own what? In their own language. And if a lot of the people that are going to be reading his Bible are following this liturgy, he reasons that, well, they might as well be able to read and understand what's going on. So if you, at the top of page 5, let's explain this a little bit. The use of Salisbury is referring to the rites and cycles of the Cathedral and Diocese of Salisbury, England, after the change to the new Sarum, is how I would say that, See the Wikipedia entry for the use of Sarum, so that's a link that you can go to. Okay, this diocese had a schedule of determined scripture readings in their lectionary to be read on certain days of the year. The Oxford Dictionary of the Christian Church explains the origins of the rite as follows, quote, Salisbury or Sarum use, the local medieval modification of the Roman rite in the use of the Catholic Church of Salisbury, traditionally ascribed to St. Osmond, 1099, but much later. The customary, i.e. the cathedral statutes and customs, and a complete directory of services was compiled by Richard Poor, 1237. The new use of Sarum was a further 14th century revision affecting certain changes in the calendar. In the latter Middle Ages, the Sarum was increasingly followed in whole or in part in the other dioceses, and in 1547 stated to be in use in nearly the whole of England, Wales, and Ireland. So this is a system of reading passages from the Old Testament on certain days of the year. Okay? So Tyndale's decision to include the Old Testament passages listed in his 1534 and 1535 Revised New Testaments was done to grant the common Englishman access to the readings of the accepted liturgy in his own tongue. Tyndale included English renderings for the following Old Testament passages, as well as the day/time of year when they were to be read as stipulated by the use of Salisbury. Okay? So let's just look at, I don't care about what day, I just want you to get a flavor of what passages are in this thing, okay? So you have Isaiah 51, Zechariah 8, Isaiah 62, Isaiah 11, Isaiah 2, Joel 2, Zechariah 2, Ecclesiastes 15, Isaiah 60, Isaiah 12, Joel 2, Isaiah 58, Exodus 24, 1 Kings 19, which would have been in the other one, by the way, Ezekiel 18, Esther 13, Genesis 37, Exodus 20, Numbers 20, Isaiah 1, Ezekiel 36, 1 Kings 17, Leviticus 19, Jeremiah 17, Isaiah 53, Exodus 12, Jeremiah 33, Amos 9, Hosea 14, Ecclesiastes 44, Ecclesiastes 24, Malachi 3, Isaiah 7, one reference to an apocryphal book, Wisdom 5, Isaiah 49, Song of Solomon 2, Proverbs 31, Ecclesiastes 24, Ezekiel 1, and Ecclesiastes 51. You can read the day and the time and the liturgy there next to each one of the references, right? So, the preceding list that I just read contains 40 English renderings or readings from 11 additional Old Testament books and one apocryphal book that are not found in either Tyndale's Pentateuch from 1530 or the Matthew's Bible from 1537. Tyndale's Salisbury translations demonstrate that his work extended to other parts of the Old Testament before his martyrdom in 1536. So if we look at our list here, is he doing more than just what's on that list? If you take into account what's included in the back of the 1534 and 1535 New Testaments. So Tyndale's work is quite extensive, and I want to show you, there's also a table. So this is like a table of, this is also in the 1534, this is a table of like responsive readings that they would follow as part of this Salisbury situation. And then here I also have the 1535, I believe. The 1535 epistle, so this is the same thing, talking about the flow and what's supposed to be read and when from the Old Testament, given that certain days and times of the year. Okay? Alright, any questions before we move on?
Isn't Ecclesiasticus part of the Apocrypha? There's only 12 chapters in Ecclesiasticus.
Then it must be, yeah. If it's 44, I was real careful to make sure I listed that stuff out right. So, and if you want to see the English renderings in a way you can actually read them, yeah, that's right. So that's probably an apocryphal book too, so I need to change that. So two apocryphal books are in the list. And again, that doesn't mean Tyndale viewed the apocrypha as canon. What it means is that he's trying to give people access to the liturgy so that they can what?
Understand.
read it and understand it. Okay. So, regarding the Salisbury Epistle, I think that should say epistles with an S, Dr. David Daniel states the following in his William Tyndale, A Biography. He says, quote, "At the back of the book are 15 pages containing 40 Old Testament passages. The extracts read on certain days in the services in Salisbury Cathedral, which Sarum use, became the basis for the first Book of Common Prayer." So you've heard of the English Book of Common Prayer, right? That English Book of Common Prayer is based heavily on this use of Sarum or Salisbury that Tyndale is translating here. Okay? So back to that, translated so that the worshipers could hear or use all the Bible passages in English. Those pages are followed by a further 18, giving a table of the set readings from epistles and gospels throughout the year, again anticipating the prayer book. So that's what this was about. That's this column here from 1534. This column's not in the 1535, but here are the table of readings from the epistles and the gospels that are also going to be used in that liturgy. So he's also laying that out so that they know. So if they had this book, if they had this 1534, would they be able to read the New Testament and the passages from the epistles and the gospels, as well as have access to the Old Testament readings to follow the liturgy in their language if they had this edition?
Yes.
Okay, that's what he's after there. "As of this date, I have not been able to ascertain with any certainty the source text for Tyndale's Old Testament Salisbury epistles. Tyndale could have used any of the following to make these translations. He could have used the Latin Vulgate. He could have used the Hebrew text, or he could have used a Latin version of the Salisbury liturgy and just translated it into what?
English.
Into English, okay? Given all that we have studied regarding the translational practices of Tyndale to date, I favor the notion that he utilized the Hebrew text, but I can offer no definitive proof of that position at this time," okay? It would seem, if he follows what he's done in other places, it would seem to make sense that he would have used the Hebrew, but it is very hard to tell. And the reason I'm saying that is I've taken this stuff to some degree. I took like 10 samples here, and I compared them to the King James Old Testament and a couple other things, and it was hard for me to figure out exactly what was going on with them. And so I'm just going to have to say that ultimately I don't know what he is translating, what his source is to translate these additional Old Testament passages that are found in the liturgy. Okay? But what I do know, this can be said, the next point can be said pretty definitively. "While proof may be lacking as to the textual basis for the Salisbury epistles, they do establish beyond doubt that Tyndale labored to revise and improve upon his Old Testament translations. These efforts on the part of Tyndale with respect to the Old Testament to revise and improve his work are consistent with what we saw in Lesson 107 when we looked at the New Testament. Regarding this matter, Dr. Brooke Fossus Westcott," terrible person, I know, states the following in his A General View of the History of the English Bible. He says, quote, "The texts of the epistles from the Old Testament," that's what we're talking about right now, okay, "appended to the New Testaments of 1534 and 1535 differ in small details from the published Pentateuch of 1531-1530. And what is still more interesting, from one another." So, what does that mean? That means that whatever he put down in his Old Testament from 1530, when he appends this stuff to his New Testament in 1534, and you compare the passages that they have in common, does he there's strong evidence that he was making changes to what he originally said here. And then there is definitive evidence that the Salisbury epistles that are appended to both of these editions here, the 1534, when he redoes it again in 1535, he makes revisions. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So I bring that up to show you, is Tyndale constantly aware of trying to improve his work? All right. The citation, this citation from the pen of Westcott contains two footnotes in support of its claims. The following are photos of Westcott's footnotes from pages 156 and 157. Okay, so there's a lot there. Let's look at. Do you see where it says P-E-N-T dot 1531, and then next to it it says New Testament 1534? Okay, so if you follow these, he originally had this dream which I have dreamed. And then in the Salisbury Epistles in 1534, he changed it to a dream that I dreamed. Lo is changed to see, and there's changes that he's making between his original Pentateuch and what he's putting in some of these Salisbury Epistles from 1534. Okay? Then underneath that, go down, underneath the line there, go down to number one, footnote number one. So he gives examples from Isaiah 53, of where, so let everybody look up here if you would. What we're going to look at now is one example of where what he said for Isaiah 53 in the Salisbury Epistles in 1534 edition, he changes or slightly alters for that same reading in the 1535. So again, is he having a mind here to continually improve what he's doing? So, for example, in Isaiah 53:6, went astray in 1534 was changed to went all of us astray in 1535. And so he's making these types of changes. In verse 12, some of this is hard to read because it's the old spelling, but you can see there that he definitely has a mind to revise things, okay? And then in the next column, he talks about how there's a couple misprints that seem to have been corrected in the 1535. So Tyndale is that type of a focused individual, even in his Old Testament work. So if we want to consider the totality of his work on the Old Testament, we have to consider Genesis through Deuteronomy. That's a D. Genesis through Deuteronomy, Joshua through 2 Chronicles, Jonah, and then these extracts of nearly 40 other passages from the Old Testament that he provided in English for the liturgy of Salisbury. Okay? Any questions? All right. The Salisbury Epistles appended to Tyndale's 1534 and 1535 Revised New Testaments contain two readings from the Pentateuch, Genesis 37 and Exodus 12. In the case of Genesis 37, see Westcott's first footnote, if one compares the readings found in Tyndale's original Pentateuch, 1531, that's his date, I don't like that date, but I went with it because that's what he said, with the various with the same passage in the Salisbury Epistles from 1534, one observes textual variants. Likewise, in Westcott's second footnote, comparing the Salisbury readings of Isaiah 53, verse 6, 8, and 12 in 1534 and his 1535 editions of his New Testament. This evidence demonstrates that Tyndale never ceased to improve upon his translations. So this is a rather abrupt conclusion, but I couldn't really figure out of a better way to sort of end this. So what I have in mind to do next week then is I want to really look at, there's one additional topic that I want to cover, and that is, as we look at William the Translator, I want to look at how Tyndale specifically handled the biblical narrative or the narrative passages of the Old Testament where he's telling these grand stories, like the fall, you know, like some of these very famous stories from the Old Testament, and how Tyndale went about stating them into English as he does his translation work. So we're going to look at that next time. Okay. Anybody have any questions or comments about any of this? Besides telling me this was boring, hopefully it was somewhat interesting to you. But you need to get a full grasp of what Tyndale's doing. So let me just say this point in conclusion. In the King James Bible, for those passages that are available from Tyndale, did that also therefore then serve as the rough draft for those passages? Yes, because Coverdale's advancing it, Matthew's advancing it, and then it ends up just like the New Testament, it ends up in this same stream of Tyndale that starts back here in the 1520s and 1530s. Words like Passover didn't exist in English until Tyndale and literally coins them when he's working on the Old Testament in 1534. Okay? Guess what word they used in English to talk about Passover before he invented Passover?
Easter.
Easter. You guys already know that, though, don't you? Because you were here when I taught that, right? So Easter, originally in Tyndale's New Testament from 1526, guess what he had every time the Greek word Pascha occurred? Easter or some transliteration of it, Pasch. Okay? So did he know something about the meaning of that word? So when that word ends up in the King James Bible in Acts 12:4 and everyone loses their mind about how this is a mistake, you need to understand something about the language and the history of the language and the usage of the words, right? Tyndale's using the word Easter before he even invents the word what? Passover in 1530. Okay? And then after next week, after we look at the biblical narrative, I'm going to teach a lesson, the last lesson on Tyndale, which is going to be on how he handled some of these controversial words and phrases, like ensample, like establish, like atonement. Romans chapter 5 verse 11, everyone loses their mind about how the King James Bible says, for we have now received what? The atonement, right? Well, that shouldn't be atonement, that should be reconciliation. Should it? Does it matter? Is it the same thing? We're going to talk about some of that stuff. Another one would be replenish. In Genesis chapter 1 verse 28, right? Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth, God says, right? That must mean, that has to mean there's a gap. Because it says replenish. I'm not saying yay or nay on gap. It's not my point. I'm saying don't argue gap on the basis of that one word, because that word maybe doesn't mean what you think it means. Tyndale, you know what Tyndale said? I'll give you a little bit of... You know what he said in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28? He said, fill. Fill the earth. If I can demonstrate that the word replenish simply is another way of saying fill, then is that six of one, half a dozen of another? Is that a different way of saying the same thing? Okay? So we're going to look at that in the last study on Tyndale. All right, we'll end there.